This is the takeaway for Wednesday, March 21st, 2018. And we've got the stories that you need to hear about today. We're covering the Austin bombings, the latest in the opioid crisis, plus what we as humans need to take away from the death of the last male white northern rhino. All that and more coming up.
There was a package that exploded inside of the home.
Police saying the city is likely facing a serial killer who has been linked to 4 bombings so far this month.
These packages are being delivered during the nighttime hours.
We have a trauma activation, 65-year-old female, penetrating trauma, head and torso.
4 bombings in the city over the past 3 weeks are linked and maybe the work of a serial bomber.
We will leave no stone unturned because we are not going to allow this to go on in our city.
I haven't heard a word about any of the Austin bombings from anyone within my community.
I'm absolutely horrified. The more it looks completely random, the more frightened I become.
We're together as people, as beings that have been affected, black and brown people being affected in the beginning, and now all of Austin being affected. So
with limited information, it causes an incredibly vulnerable feeling, thinking schools will be targeted next.
It's so hard to have your community in the national news about something that is so terrible and so distant from everything your community is known for.
It has been a long, almost 3 weeks for the community of Austin. Package bombs and other types of bombs that have been placed throughout our community. We have seen members of our community that have lost their lives and others whose lives have been forever changed due to significant injuries. But beginning within the past 24 to 36 hours, we started getting information on one person of interest. We felt very confident that this was the suspect in the bombing incidents that took place in Austin. As members of the Austin Police Department SWAT team approached the vehicle, the suspect detonated a bomb inside the vehicle. The suspect is deceased. We do not know what the motive was behind that, and hopefully as we continue this investigation, we will uncover some facts so that we can try and understand, although this is something that there is no rationale for, but we can try and understand what his motive was. Thank you very much.
Late last night, a suspect in the bombings that have terrorized the Austin metropolitan area in Texas blew himself up in a car in the town of Round Rock after being chased by police. You heard the voices of worried and concerned citizens around Austin there. You also heard Police Chief Brian Manley describe the suspect's death there in a press conference early this morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Saeed Hassan has joined us since the beginning of this crisis in Austin. Saeed is a reporter for KUT, and she's back now with the latest. Saeed, welcome once again.
Thank you for having me.
Saeed, tell us some of the details of what happened overnight as described by Chief Brian Manley there and others you've spoken to.
Sure. So last night, the suspect in the Austin bombings was killed after a standoff with an Austin Police Department SWAT team. And this happened in the early morning hours in Round Rock, which is a suburb of Austin. Investigators say they located a vehicle that they believed was being used by the suspect in a parking lot of a hotel. And they called for backup. And while they were awaiting for backup to arrive, the suspect began to drive away. At that point, police pursued him in their vehicle. And that's when they say the suspect stopped his vehicle in a ditch along the side of a highway frontage road. And as that SWAT team approached him, the suspect detonated a bomb inside of his vehicle, ultimately killing himself.
Now, the chief said that that individual was a suspect before the chase, that they were closing in on him. He started to drive away, as you said, Saeeda. What have officials said about the information that led them to suspect this person?
Well, we don't know a whole lot about the suspect at this time. Police have said that he was a 24-year-old white male, but police really haven't released a lot of information. They're still working to investigate what exactly the motivation for these attacks may have been, and I'm sure we'll hear more in the days to come.
And have police determined whether this individual acted alone or had help?
We don't know for sure. So that's another reason why our police chief, Brian Manley, is encouraging residents to remain vigilant, because we don't know whether this suspect acted alone or whether there may be other people still out there in the community who may also have been involved in the attacks. So, you know, the police chief encourages residents, though there is somewhat of a sense of relief after the events of the early morning hours, that folks still need to be vigilant and, you know, still be mindful of any suspicion suspicious packages or anything that looks out of place in the community.
Right. I imagine there also has to be the very real possibility that other packages could be in the mail system, FedEx, or in places around Austin that may have been placed or sent before the events of last night.
That's right. So Chief Manley noted that, you know, police actually don't know for sure where this suspect was for the past 24 hours before they located him in the vehicle outside of that hotel room. So, you know, there's nothing to say that there may not be other packages or devices that have been left throughout Austin before they came into contact with him. So they're still encouraging folks to be mindful, to continue to call 911 if they come across any suspicious packages. I know police have been just inundated with hundreds and hundreds of calls since they have asked people to report any suspicious packages. And they say just keep on doing that, continue to act out of an abundance of caution.
Well, Saida, we've talked about this as you've joined us so many times during these horrible attacks around Austin, but give a sense as possibly we get to the end of this terrible episode about the attitude and the fear among Austin residents. So much of these attacks seem to be random. It reminds me of attacks like the D.C. sniper attacks in 2002 when people were being shot around the D.C. metro area and citizens just had no idea who was next, being shot at bus stops outside of their cars. The randomness of it was a major tyranny on people.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like what I've heard folks expressing here in Austin over the past 3 weeks. I think that especially with the changing nature of these attacks, with the tripwire and then the packages being shipped through FedEx, that, you know, it seemed really random and really unpredictable. And there wasn't really a way to tell, you know, where this attacker may strike again. And, you know, people were already being mindful of packages, but then things seemed to change. You know, his tactics seemed to change. So after last night, I do think that there is somewhat of a sense of relief in the neighborhood. I've heard a lot of folks expressing on social media that they hope that this is over. But you know, again, I think that there is still somewhat of a sense of uncertainty, and folks are aware that they need to remain vigilant.
Saida Hassan, reporter for KUT in Austin. Saida, thank you, and thank you for joining us as this episode has unfolded in your town.
Thank you for having me.
Six bombs around Austin over the span of 3 weeks. The White House said yesterday there's no apparent nexus to terrorism at this time. And last night, an employee at a Goodwill store outside Austin was injured when a military incendiary device went off while he was moving boxes. Now, investigators don't think that incident is connected to the others. Still, investigators have said the various other bombings across the Austin area seem to be linked. But how do they go about trying to piece together evidence and trying to construct a motive of the person or people responsible? Vicky Woosley is a retired FBI agent who worked on lots of cases, including the Unabomber case, when she was a supervisory special agent in the Psychological Services Unit.
I was not a profiler, but generally I do know that bombers have some common characteristics, and that is, it's a risk. What they're doing is a risk. And that may provide some sort of thrill for the bomb maker. There's a fact that bomb may or may not go off. It may not hit their intended target. And they also risk getting caught when they make the delivery. It'd be impossible to really give a profile without all of the evidence.
The first couple of attacks in Austin, of course, there was suspicion of racial animus. How important are those early days? I don't know if that was only media speculation or if investigators and profilers really chase down potential motives like that. What a psychological profile is like so early in an investigation?
I think early in the investigation, there's sort of no stone left unturned. You want to look at every possibility. And then as you gather more evidence, you're able to eliminate some of those things. If we only had those two incidents, then that's all we would have to look at. But I think in this case in particular, you know, there were several incidents pretty quickly in timing. And so it grew because there were, you know, it was a neighborhood, then it was FedEx, and then it was a tripwire. So they're able to continue to gather evidence. So they don't eliminate anything until they've chased down every lead.
Is there anything that typically drives a person in cases like this, a desire to be heard or an ideological grievance, something like that?
Well, I think it's one of the reasons I believe the Austin police tried to reach out to this individual and ask them to contact the authorities, because if they had a message, they wanted to indicate that they were willing to have that heard. It could be an ideology. It could be, you know, any number of things. But in order to reach out to that person, the hope is that they will, you know, respond in some way, because that could be part of what they're looking for, the attention.
You know, we've heard from a lot of confused and scared members of the community around Austin. At a time like this, does deep community concern help or hinder an investigation? I mean, people are vigilant. They have to be. The community has to be informed. But Austin police have said they've responded to more than 1,200 reports of suspicious packages in little more than a week. Most of them, of course, amount to nothing. And that's a huge tax on resources.
Yeah, it's labor intensive. You're absolutely right. You have to chase down every lead because you don't know which ones could be the one. And so they are, you know, asking the public for help. They're also asking the public, you know, for any videos they may have, any surveillance they may have. I think that's become more common the more we see social media, the more we see people having cameras at their houses. And I think there's a fine line between informing the public and also trying to not scare them.
Based on your experience, digging into the psychology of assailants like this, and we don't know if it's one person or many people, people like the Unabomber and other assailants, what would you expect to find in general when investigators piece together the profile, the age, the demo, the psychology of a suspect here?
You know, right now we know very little, but they will start now working in reverse and trying to put together a complete outline of this individual, everything from family, friends, where they worked, and get as much as a narrative as possible on this person to, you know, people have this desire to, they want to know why someone did something. And I think that's what they will start to do at this point. I think it's pretty remarkable that they were able to move in on a suspect so quickly. And, you know, I'll be very interested to see, you know, what sort of information they had that led to this. There's certain things that they have to keep close to the vest in order to keep the investigation safe. Investigations like this are difficult. You have to work in reverse, as they did in the Boston Marathon bombing. But you can't neglect to look at every clue and every call that someone makes into authorities, because that could be the clue that you need.
Vicki Woosley, former supervisory special agent in the Psychological Services Unit at the FBI. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's just so hard to wrap your arms around the fact that your child would do heroin.
She told me that day in the hospital, I'm not done using. And I was like, oh, hell yeah, you are.
It's not that OxyContin is particularly powerful. It's that pain is particularly confounding.
Every muscle and bone in your body hurts.
It's so important for the mental health and substance abuse issues to be treated together.
The opioid crisis in America is showing no signs of letting up. On Monday, President Trump talked about it from New Hampshire, one of the state's hardest hit by the epidemic.
We're going to solve this problem. We're going to solve it with brains. We're going to solve it with resolve. We're going to solve it with toughness. Because toughness is the thing that they most fear.
They, according to the president, are drug dealers and drug traffickers. And toughness, according to a new plan that the president announced, means harsher sentences and longer prison terms and even the death penalty for drug dealing in some cases. Germán López, senior reporter for Vox, says President Trump focused a lot on criminal justice and toughness in his speech, but that the plan has two other main points.
The other is our efforts to reduce the amount of opioid prescriptions. The White House has a plan to essentially, their goal is to reduce opioid prescriptions by a third over the next 3 years. They're kind of vague on exactly how they'll accomplish this, but they said that they'll tie, for example, Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements to best practices for prescribing, and that should bring down the amount of prescribing. And then the last leg of this plan is these vague promises so far to boost addiction treatment and harm reduction policies. It's not totally clear how they'll accomplish this, and the president spent very little time detailing this part in his speech. I think he gave like maybe one or two sentences to treatment. And otherwise, the plan doesn't really have much in the terms of details, because what you really want to see in terms of boosting access to addiction treatment is money, resources. How much money are you putting to this? And the plan just doesn't have those details. But those are generally the three big parts. And the biggest part seems to be the criminal justice punishment stuff.
Okay, so some nods to addiction treatment and harm reduction, some nods also to reducing opioid prescriptions, and lots of focus on law and order. What are experts telling you about what they see in this plan, at least as it stands so far?
I mean, experts generally like the stuff that Trump isn't emphasizing. So the treatment stuff, that's like particularly what, if you talk to opioid policy experts, that's what they want to see. That's what they want to see the big focus on. The New York Times recently did this piece on how would you spend $100 billion over 5 years. And nearly half, on average, based on talking to 30 experts, would it go to treatment. So that's what experts really want this to focus on. And then there is some talk still about reducing the amount of opioid prescriptions. The U.S. still prescribes way more opioids than other countries around the world. But the criminal justice stuff, that's what experts want de-emphasized. I mean, we've tried these strategies in past drug crises. We tried it during the crack cocaine epidemic. We tried it during the meth epidemic. We tried it during the previous heroin epidemic in the 70s. And really, these policies just don't seem to be very effective. I mean, we've had these policies in place for decades now, and we still have the opioid epidemic. So that's a sign that like these policies aren't very effective, and generally, that's what they want to emphasize. So to some degree, what President Trump has emphasized is kind of backwards, whereas like the president is emphasizing this criminal justice stuff, but experts want the treatment stuff. And that seems to be a big conflict right now.
Well, is the president going to leave a lot of the details to Congress then? House Republicans are ramping up their efforts on opioids now. They're holding hearings this week talking about a bunch of different bills. What's the strategy coming from Congress? Are we going to see more detailed plans from them?
So far, we are seeing a bunch of bills coming out of Congress. In terms of like they're working on these bills, it's not totally clear just how likely all these are to pass or what the final package that does pass will look like. But generally, Congress does seem to be taking more of a detailed approach towards this crisis in terms of like right now, today and tomorrow, they're really focusing on these hearings in terms of like 20 plus bills. And these bills really, there's just an enormous variety in them. So some of them focus on improving FDA regulations in terms of how the FDA approves opioids to consider misuse and that kind of thing. Some of them are about boosting access to treatment and making sure that hospitals, when they discharge somebody who came in with an opioid overdose, that they're being connected to treatment and that kind of thing. And that's all public health stuff. There's really been very little attention in terms of ramping up punishment like the president is talking about.
If Congress is taking more of a public health approach here, Herman, have they shown any interest so far in a get tough approach or the criminal justice approach that the president seems interested in?
No, in fact, some Republican members of Congress have actually said that they're worried that the president's focus on criminal justice and particularly the death penalty will draw too much attention away from the proposals that experts like that will actually solve the crisis. I think that's because these kinds of proposals will probably need bipartisan support to get through the Senate. And Democrats and a lot of Republicans increasingly want the criminal justice system to head in the opposite direction. There's been a lot of talk about criminal justice reform in the past few years, and they would like to see punishment for drug offenses actually reduce. So this idea that the opioid crisis demands a tougher view is just something that seems kind of outdated in Congress. That's not to say that they don't think the criminal justice system or law enforcement shouldn't play a role in the opioid epidemic, but they don't think that they should take a punitive, tough-on-crime, 1980s, 1990s, war-on-drugs style approach.
And what about money, Herman? Let's talk about money. There's an omnibus spending deal in the works by week's end. A lot of these opioid policies will come after that. But is the money that Congress is committing to the opioid epidemic going to be significant here?
It is a significant amount of money in terms of, like, it's $6 billion over 2 years. That's what Congress is aiming for. The thing is that when you talk to experts about this, they'll like call this the elephant in the room. They'll say that this is like really the big sticking point, because as much as $6 billion over 2 years is in general, this is a crisis that has now reached a level of devastation that's like comparable to, I mean, the HIV/AIDS crisis in the 1990s. It now kills more people. Drug overdoses now kill more people than HIV/AIDS did at its peak. So the federal government right now spends about $20 billion a year on HIV/AIDS. And that's kind of the investment that when you talk to drug policy experts and opioid policy advocates, that's the kind of investment they want to see. So as promising as the $6 billion over 2 years is, they really want much more money. With that said, I mean, this is better than nothing, right? So $6 billion over 2 years, that could do quite a bit to boost access to treatment and boost access to harm reduction efforts like naloxone, the opioid overdose antidote. So that's something that people are glad to see. It's just a question of, is that enough?
Herman Lopez, senior reporter for Vox. Herman, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
As we heard at the top of the show today, a man suspected of being responsible for the bombings in Austin, Texas, has died as police closed in on his car outside of the city. In the small town of Garden City, Kansas, though, in 2016, things never got to that point. That's because FBI agents foiled a deadly bomb plot aimed at the area's Somalian community before anyone was hurt. And the trial of three men accused in that plot began this week. FBI agents say the men formed a militia group called the Crusaders and that they planned to attack a Somali housing complex just one day after the 2016 elections in November. All three of the men are charged with conspiring to use a weapon of mass destruction, and if convicted, they could face life in prison. Frank Morris is national correspondent and senior editor at KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. Frank, good to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you.
Frank, remind us of the details of this alleged plot. What kind of damage were these three men looking to inflict, according to the government?
They wanted to level an apartment complex of eight buildings on the outskirts of Garden City, Kansas, a town of about 24,000 people. They talked about different ways of doing this. The most elaborate one was to bring in four van loads of explosives, park them at the corners of the vehicle, and target the charge toward the center. And then they were planning, allegedly, to shoot anybody staggering out of this enormous explosion they were hoping to touch off. This apartment complex has at least 120 people, mainly East African immigrants.
And what have prosecutors said was the motive here? What were these men trying to accomplish by targeting the complex in this way?
These guys just hated Muslim immigrants and abused them, especially women, whenever they got a chance. The leader of this group, Patrick Stein, just routinely referred to Muslim Somalis as cockroaches, famously said the only good Muslim is a dead Muslim. So this was raw hatred as a motive, allegedly.
Now, the plot never came to fruition. It was foiled by the FBI. How did they stop it?
Well, interestingly enough, there's sort of three men in this so-called militia group, the Crusaders. There was a fourth Crusader, and that was someone who was an acquaintance of Stein's, who immediately, as this plot started to come together, notified the FBI, became a paid confidential informant, and wore a wire, recorded these conversations for months. They'd had these meetings once a week or so. And so that person arguably risked their lives to stop this plot from taking hold. That person eventually introduced an FBI agent posing as an underworld crime guy who was going to get them machine guns and high explosives, and eventually sort of led Stein through the end points of the plot. And then one of the Crusaders was arrested for domestic battery. And that sort of hastened the end of the plot. The FBI was all over this plot long before it ever would have been executed.
So it sounds like after a certain point, this was sort of a what we think of as a stage-managed plot once the FBI had infiltrated this group. Frank, Garden City is one of three towns in the area with large immigrant populations. Listen here to Mbio Farah, an 18-year-old Somali immigrant in Liberal, Kansas.
This is the place. It used to be the place, but now it's a ghost town. There is no one here. It used to be really beautiful, have all this African lightings and have someone standing here dressed in their African clothing just to welcome you, say hi, give you a candy or something if you have a kid with you, but there's no one here now.
Frank, can you talk about the effects of this case on the area, on its Somali population and the people who may have been targeted here?
The first thing about this Somali refugees is virtually all of them fled civil war in Somalia, and a lot of them spent time in refugee camps in between leaving Somalia, coming to the United States. So it was really traumatic for them to find out that some guys hated them enough just on their face to want to kill them. That triggered some ancient old feelings with these folks. It was very traumatic. But the effects have played out differently in different towns. Liberal is maybe, ironically, maybe the most conservative of these three towns. And two of the guys involved in this plot, allegedly involved in this plot, were from Liberal. So the Somali community there there's been an exodus of Somalis. And Ambio was one of the, she says 16 Somalis left in town, was talking about an African grocery store downtown Liberal that used to be thought of as kind of Somali Junction. There was an apartment building full of Somalis. There was a mosque right down the street. That's all emptied out. However, in Garden City, the town that was where the plot was supposed to take place, where the explosion was supposed to take place, the Somali community is actually larger than it was before. People from Liberal, some of them moved to Garden City. Garden City made a really strong effort to reach out to people. Before the plot was announced to the media, the leaders, the sort of tribal leaders in Garden City knew about it because the police chief, Michael Utes, made sure they knew about it so that they would feel a little bit more secure. And also in Garden City, there was a huge public outpouring of support for these immigrants. People of, you know, various races, all kinds of races, walking up and down the sidewalk, holding signs, "We love you, you know, Garden City, the world grows here," over and over again. Not just one, several of these demonstrations, tons of meetings. So the Garden City handled this very, very proactively. And because of that, you know, while people are still nervous, they feel threatened in a way that they didn't realize they were threatened before, they're more secure in Garden City.
Three men who allegedly called themselves the Crusaders and targeted an apartment block housing Somali refugees in Kansas on trial for weapons of mass destruction. Frank Morris, national correspondent and senior editor at KCUER in Kansas City, Missouri. Frank, thank you.
Nice talking with you, Todd.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The most famous rhino in the world died on Monday. His name was Sudan. He was 45 years old, and he was the last remaining male northern white rhino. There are two females left of the species, but neither of them are capable of breeding. And that means that barring some great technological feat, the northern white rhino will soon be extinct. It's a time to consider humanity's role and our sense of responsibility here, says Jennifer Jaquette. Jaquette is a professor of environmental studies at NYU and author of the book, Is Shame Necessary? New Uses for an Old Tool.
Sudan was the last male living white rhino. He was a captive reminder of the extinction crisis, and he did not exactly die, you know, as a lot of the headlines said, but he was put down. So he was euthanized. And I would say his whole sort of life, death, and, you know, now the way that we're talking about him really is part of this sixth extinction that we're living through, and a reminder that humans are just so very much in charge right now. And so with his death, you see a kind of public response, but then you also see the very, very personal response of the people who actually knew him and, you know, that took care of him every day, and the great feeling of loss that comes from knowing an individual who also happens to be, you know, one of the last members of his species. This is really Africa's moment like that. But there have been others like this in history. You know, Martha, the last passenger pigeon, died in the Cincinnati Zoo. Lonesome George in the Galapagos Islands, the last Pinta Island giant tortoise, he died in 2012. We're seeing not only that we understand extinctions from this broad conceptual idea of fossils, which is what we knew in the 18th century, but now these animals are like living fossils, you know, and their end is almost preordained as a great sadness and anticipated as such.
Well, put Sudan into the context of what you mentioned, the sixth extinction. It's a term coined by Elizabeth Colbert. She wrote a book by the same title. This is a much broader phenomenon. And you talk about these two sides of it, the mass extinction of species all over the world that humans are responsible for, and then our focus, sort of our sentimentality for the last ones of an individual species.
Yeah, I mean, we're living through the sixth extinction, which humans are responsible for, and even broader context, this idea of the Anthropocene, the idea that humans are really in the driver's seat and that we are a geologic force, that we are changing the earth so much and the inhabitants who live there. So it's interesting to me that you have this idea conceptually, right? And then we have these moments where we can really see that when we see the last individual die in captivity. And this is almost like a weird existential crisis when this occurs. I mean, like I said, it's very personal for some of the people that knew these animals. And then there's the broader social context, which is that we're all, as humans, grappling with this new role that we're playing as, you know, kind of completely in charge of these animals' fate. And so you have kind of two, I would say, responses for the people that feel bad about this is, and I would say my response is, we need to do something about the issues that are causing extinction. So habitat loss in the case of the northern white rhino, we need to do something about the trade for rhino horn, the demand for traditional medicine, the demand for the horn to be used in these dagger handles. And frankly, I don't want to see white rhinos brought back into the world until these issues are dealt with. But then there's another camp that says, we don't really need to deal with the issues that are causing extinction, or these issues may sort themselves out over time. The important thing is we maintain this genetic diversity, and they want to bring the white rhino back through technological solutions like in vitro fertilization and a process called de-extinction, where you're using genetic material, sometimes combining it with other like close animals, because the white rhino is actually a subspecies. You could use other species of rhino to sort of recreate these animals. So there's some very strange discourse around all of this. And I'd say a lot of it, though, is symbolic of the issues that we're facing with almost all of these issues, like climate change. Some of us want to mitigate carbon emissions. Others of us take a more technological approach that, oh, we'll be able to address the emissions or soak up the carbon in a technological fashion. So yeah, a lot of this maps well onto the discussions that we're grappling with on so many other large-scale planetary issues.
Do we understand ourselves any better when a rhino like Sudan dies and a species becomes extinct?
I think we understand the predicament we're in, and a lot of us grasp the idea that we're behind it. So, you know, extinction is a relatively recent idea in human history, and it was really only at the end of the 18th century that we kind of understood, at least in Western culture, that the extinction crisis was a real thing, or I shouldn't say the crisis, the phenomenon. And that was really understood through the fossil record. So most of us, including me, I mean, my experience with extinction, especially as a kid, were the dinosaurs. The idea that, oh, this was something that happened in the past, and the animals have been evolving, and they've been disappearing. But now, when these animals, the last of their kind, like Sudan, disappear, we say, oh, no, but we're watching these animals disappear before our very eyes. This is a really uncomfortable feeling. And again, reminding us that we're in the driver's seat. And unlike Lonesome George, where, you know, habitat loss was the primary issue for the Pinta Island giant tortoise, we're talking about direct exploitation. Rhinos are dying because poachers are killing them. And we have to grapple with that as a species, that this is a very direct result of of human intervention, of humanity leading to this extinction. And that's a heavy cross to bear. And I think it does make us see ourselves and the problems we're creating for other animals in a new way. But other people, again, they apply a kind of balm to this wound by just thinking, okay, yes, we're losing species, but we're becoming so technologically adept that we will change the world and we will bring them back and they will come back to a world that is decent or maybe even better for them, like wolves in Yellowstone or something like that. And, you know, maybe on a good day I can get on board. But right now I really think, you know, I don't want to see the white rhino brought back to a world where we haven't addressed the problems that brought them to this brink of extinction to begin with.
Jennifer Jaquette, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Jaquette is a professor of environmental studies at NYU and author of Is Shame Necessary? New Uses for an Old Tool. Well, we asked on our Facebook page if you feel responsible when you hear stories like the death of Sudan, the last male northern white rhino. Caitlin told us, "I am ashamed of every little thing I do that contributes to the demise of the creatures of this earth. We have so much culpability, and we do so little to change." But Greg wrote this to us, "There are inequalities and tragedies occurring every single day across the globe. Were I to be forced to feel guilty for every single one of those events because of my inaction, I would live a life hardly worth living." You can always weigh in, share your thoughts with us on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway, and we always want to hear from you on this show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.